From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Italy called for the temporary shutdown of all retailers in that country yesterday, meaning that most non-essential stores, restaurants, bars, you name it, with the exception of supermarkets and pharmacies, will be closed in Italy, furthering life under lockdown there. Recall that movement in Italy has been restricted until April 3rd, at least. Now, the United States hasn't reached that point yet, even as communities across this country are making hour-by-hour decisions on how to stem the coronavirus pandemic, meaning the economic impact from coronavirus will reach far beyond people who fall sick. For millions of Americans already living paycheck to paycheck, also living with debt and little savings, being out of work means a lot more than just being out of luck. So this hour on Point, we're going to look at how coronavirus is shining an even brighter spotlight on inequality, economic fragility, and the fraying of the social safety net in America. And we're going to start today with a worker. Trisha Pettit joins us today from Bloomington, Indiana. She's a server at a local bar and restaurant in Bloomington. Trisha, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about your life right now. How's your income doing? Do you feel secure economically?
So I'm a student in Bloomington, Indiana. And like you said, I work at a restaurant and bar. I pretty much live paycheck to paycheck with that. But I usually have some savings. But I was pretty sick last month and had to take some time off work and depleted most of my savings. So I am kind of worried that if I have to take some time off work for being sick again, or if not a lot of people start coming out, that I'm not going to get the tips I need to pay the bills.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit more, Trisha, if we could. So first of all, just say you got sick again and you had to be out of work for at least a couple of weeks, maybe even a month, for as long as you needed to. I mean, what would that immediately mean? Would it mean that you have no savings to rely on at all?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, would that mean that would you be at risk of like, housing insecurity, food insecurity?
We have so many local food banks here in Bloomington that I would be able to rely on, thankfully. But I would have to ask friends to help out with rent. I really don't know what I would do.
Okay. And do you have, I mean, you work at a bar and restaurant, so do you have, is there any paid leave of any kind where you work?
No. No.
Okay. That's not uncommon in the restaurant and bar industry. Now, what about even if you were able to still go to work, but because people would stop coming out or they were recommended to not go to, places where there's a lot of folks, how much would that impact you?
That would also be pretty detrimental since, I know most service industry workers, including myself, work on very, very low wages because we're just expected to make our living on tips. If nobody came out, I really wouldn't be making any money, even if I was still able to be at work.
Yeah. So have the employees, have the managers or the owners of the place where you work, has this become part of the discussion there?
Not yet. Really, we don't have any cases of COVID-19 in Monroe County, Indiana. So it hasn't really been a topic of discussion yet.
Do you think people ought to start talking about it and planning what to do?
I do think we should start discussing it, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me one more thing here, Trisha. I mean, the reason why we wanted to have this discussion this hour is because, as I said earlier, like, coronavirus is one of those things that's just really just shining a bright spotlight on issues that were already existing in America.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you had the ear of, governor of Indiana, the president, whomever, that could make a difference, what change would you ask for?
Definitely access to better health care. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have healthcare through my parents since I'm still under that age. But if I didn't have healthcare from my parents, I don't know what I would do if I got sick. I don't know how I would pay for that. Obviously, I don't have any more savings to pay for rent if I were to be out of work. I don't know how I would pay for any medical bills.
Hmm. Well, Tricia Pettit, she works at a bar and restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana, joining us from Bloomington. Tricia, thank you so much for telling us your story and for spending the time with us. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, Tricia is one of millions of stories of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. And this hour, we are taking a look at the impact that the coronavirus pandemic may have on them, which is maybe you listening right now. Well, joining us now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is our very own On Point News analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, it's great to have you on the show today.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, Jack, give us your sense. I mean, Tricia is, as I said, but one of millions of stories. I mean, I think there are, what, some 50-60% of Americans who are already living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, what does that tell you about the vulnerabilities that exist in the system as it is?
Well, Tricia is a member of the American precariat, the 23 million mostly hourly paid workers who work in the hotel and food service industries and who do not receive any sick days, compared to 97% of people who work in the financial industry. So 45% in restaurant and service, 97% in finance get sick pay. Who are their employers? Burger King, Chick-fil-A, Jack in the Box, Wendy's, Panera, no sick leave. And why is that? It's been, according to one account, 16 years, Democrats in Congress have tried to get this. But the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association, mm-hmm. has successfully lobbied against it, which gives mostly to Republicans. And no less than 30 of its 36 leading lobbyists have former government or, Capitol Hill connections. So it's a very well-wired lobby that has beaten back attempts to give more security to this large and growing population of Americans.
Hmm. And you know what's interesting to me, Jack, about what might economically befall Americans due to the coronavirus is because this isn't an individual sector problem, right? Like when we talk about different temporary downturns in the economy, it might hit particular sectors harder than others. But if we're talking about an overall slowdown in the services that people seek out in a service-based economy like we are now, you can imagine the downstream effects for workers who may, you know, who might not be serving at tables, but you know, who are in other places in the chain of service. They are going to be impacted too.
Oh, they are. And that's why I see just this morning Larry Summers ups his estimate of a recession to 80%. Because this, and I think Mohammed El-Aryan on the Morning Edition put it well the other day, we're going to see the economics of fear. And it's going to take it's going to work right across the economy, but it will most hurt people who are already vulnerable, who are already either food insecure, who have, you know, work for employers who do not provide benefits, and who are just sort of hanging on, or like Tricia, can't even begin to think about health insurance. And the question is, what should we do? How comprehensive should the national response be? The president is already getting low marks for his speech last night as not reassuring. Mm. Certainly didn't reassure the markets, and is containing as falling way behind the pace of this, an intensity of this pandemic.
Indeed. Well, to that point, Jack, I just want to play a moment from when Vice President Mike Pence spoke on Tuesday, and he mentioned that the president, which was reaffirmed last night in the president's speech, but that Mike Pence said the president is considering asking for a payroll tax holiday to relieve financial burdens placed on American workers due to coronavirus.
We want to make sure that hourly workers, hardworking blue-collar Americans that may not have paid family leave today, that small and medium-sized businesses in America would be afforded the resources to provide paid leave so that no one would feel that they have to go to work if they might be infected or if they might have been exposed.
So that was Vice President Mike Pence just yesterday. Jack, what do you think? I mean, a payroll tax holiday, the question is, who would be the greatest beneficiaries of that, right? It wouldn't be the lower wage workers that we're thinking about at the moment, would it?
Not if they were laid off. It's a tax on employment.
Exactly.
Now, it's a very regressive tax. 68% of Americans pay more in that tax than in income taxes. And people who are self-employed, like Uber drivers and so on, they don't just pay the 6%, they have to pay the whole 12%. So any tax relief on Social Security for them would be welcome. But it doesn't deal with the question, with the problem that Tricia is facing and many of these 23 million people in the service industry are going to face, which is being out of work.
Well, Jack Beatty's On Point News analyst. Jack, stand by for just a moment because we are talking now about the economic impact that coronavirus is having and will have on American workers. Those millions of Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck in any number of industries in this country. We want to hear more of your stories. Is this you? Are we talking about you? How are you going to cope? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the economic impact of coronavirus on American workers, those who might get sick and have to miss out on work, and those who might get put out of work because of the reduction in the economic activity, particularly in the service sector, that would come along with coronavirus mitigation efforts and what impact that's going to have on folks. And I'm joined today by Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. He's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And we were talking about the restaurant industry in the previous segment of the program. And I want to shift our focus a little bit to workers within healthcare itself. So let's take a minute to listen to the story told to NPR by Shelley Hughes. She is a certified nurse's aide at a nursing home in Washington State. She spoke late last week with NPR business correspondent Alina Selyuk, and Alina kindly shared a lot of that conversation with us. So first of all, let's listen to Shelley Hughes talking to Alina about the characteristics and skills it takes to work in a nursing home, even on the best of days.
Well, you have to have a big heart. You have to have a strong stomach. You have to have a strong back. Really important. You've got to have, you know, maxed out levels of empathy and endurance to care for people sometimes when they're in, you know, the darkest times in their life, at the end of their life, when they're going through unimaginable things, cancer and stroke, dementia, Alzheimer's. And treat them with the dignity and respect that they deserve, and ensure the highest quality of care possible. And to continue to do that in the face of short staffing, in the face of budget cuts, and all of the other extraneous stuff that tends to happen to interfere with our calling, which is providing care to people. Other than that, there's just kind of a high level of anxiety as everyone is waiting to see what happens.
Well, Shelley Hughes, again, she's a certified nurse's aide at a nursing home in Washington State. And she says at her facility, they're all waiting and worried about what might happen because they are already short-staffed. And if anybody spikes a temperature or starts showing signs of infection, they will not be able to go to work, which means the residents they serve won't get the care they need. And even though Shelley herself is a member of a union, SEIU 775, she's worried that if she gets sick, she won't be able to make ends meet.
I would only be paid if I had sick time or vacation time or short-term disability insurance. You know, the facility would not pay me to stay home if I was sick. You know, I've worked there for so long that I do have vacation time. And in a way, I'm lucky that I actually have health insurance, that I could, you know, see a doctor, go to the hospital if I actually needed it. Most of the other nurses' aides in my facility, you know, they don't have health insurance. Our facility offers health insurance, but it's really expensive and has very high deductibles. The only reason I have insurance is that, you know, I'm the sole breadwinner for my family, and so we qualify for the state Medicaid program, the Apple Health. So I have, you know, basic Medicaid insurance. I don't know if it would cover the test for coronavirus, because the test, as far as we know, is very expensive, and it's about, you know, $3,000 or more to be tested to see if you have the disease.
And that cost that Shelley was referencing was if you're asymptomatic at the moment and request the coronavirus test where she is. Now, Shelley works the night shift at the nursing home facility where she's been for many, many years. She goes into work at 10 p.m. every night and leaves at 6 a.m. in the morning. And she says she's going to keep doing that every day that she can. And she'll do it with optimism, levity, and a smile.
That is how us, you know, healthcare, you know, providers, us healthcare workers are dealing with the situation. We have to use levity. We make so many jokes when we're at work. You have to have that kind of attitude to be able to get up every day and go to a work site that's a potential vector for a horrible disease. You know, we're facing potentially not just the loss of our livelihood, but, you know, potentially the loss of people that we care for, that we care for. And, you know, that's very scary.
That's Shelley Hughes. She's a certified nurse's aide at a nursing home in Washington State. She spoke late last week with NPR business correspondent Alina Selyuk, and we have to send our sincere thanks to Alina for sharing Shelley's story with us. Alina has done some excellent reporting on the impact of coronavirus on healthcare workers and home healthcare workers in particular, and we have a link to Alina's reporting at onpointradio.org. Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Jay Shamba. He joins us from Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University. Jay Shamba, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the thing about Shelley Hughes' story that really stuck with me is that Shelley's a unionized worker, right? She belongs to SEIU. She's been working at the same facility for many years. It's a highly skilled job, being a certified aide in a nursing home. And yet you heard, she said her own colleagues, some of them can't afford health insurance. She's the only breadwinner for her family. There's the evidence of uncertainty, you know, even in Shelley's story here. So what is that telling us right now about what coronavirus might do economically to people?
I think when we look at any situation where there's a potential downturn in the economy, one thing it really reveals is the extent of vulnerability in the population, that there are a lot of people really kind of living on the edge of just getting by. And it highlights that we need, when we face a crisis like this, we need to do everything we can to backstop those people, to make sure that they have the resources they need. It's not about getting them to go on a shopping spree. It's about making sure they have enough resources to pay rent, to feed their family, and to provide health care.
Well, so we were talking with Jack earlier in the show about the proposal for a payroll tax relief. Is that an immediate, effective frontline backstop?
No, just to be blunt. And I say this not in any kind of partisan way. Actually, when we wrote something on the Hamilton Project, where I'm the director on the blog there last week. And one nice thing about that is if you put out your views before any politician, then no one can accuse you of kind of changing your views to match any kind of politics. But A payroll tax cut, you and Jack talked about some of the flaws in it, and they're just really important to reemphasize, which is it only goes to people who are working. And so that's a real problem. Mm-hmm. It's biased towards higher income people in that if you earn $100,000 a year, a 2% payroll tax cut is $2,000. That's great. But if you earn $10,000, it's $200. It also gets phased in slowly because, you're only getting it in your paycheck in dribs and drabs. And we actually know how to do something better. We've done it twice before, which is just actually sending checks to people. So this was done in a bipartisan way in 2008. President Bush, a Republican, and a Democratic Congress joined together and they sent checks out. And, the research suggests it was actually quite helpful. Helpful to households to give them a buffer, but also helpful to the economy. And so I would be really hopeful that people could kind of switch their views around on this a little and recognize that what we should be doing, if what we want to do is get resources to people, you can just send the same amount of money to everybody. That way, if someone's lost their job, they still get it. If it's a worker like Tricia that you spoke to earlier who, is relying on tips and commission and her actual payroll tax may not be that high, she's getting a check that is a meaningful amount that's giving her a cushion. And so it's the kind of thing we could do that if you're giving people a cushion, it means if you think maybe you shouldn't go to work because you might be sick, it might be the thing that lets you make that good decision as opposed to putting people in these impossible positions where I think I might have a fever, but if I don't go to work, I'm going to get evicted. That's not where you want people to be in a public health crisis.
So let's remind folks a little bit about what you were talking about after in 2008, in the midst of the financial crisis. The government sent out checks in kind of various tranches. What was the maximum amount? What was it, $500-$600 per
household? I believe it was
household?
It was $600, I think, to an individual, okay, and another $300 for children. And so, for a family of four, that can start to add up. You're over $1,500 at that point. And so, or not quite. And so I think it's the kind of thing that we could do in a meaningful way. It would give people resources. It would make sure people don't have to go to work when they shouldn't. And it would, frankly, give people some peace of mind in terms of if I'm going to lose hours. I think about I'm so glad you talked to Tricia to start because I think she highlights all of these issues that there are a lot of workers that may not lose their jobs, but they are going to lose tips, commission, overtime, hours. People who are gig workers are going to lose a lot of income,
right,
potentially. People with second jobs, the NBA just shut down. There are a lot of people who work, whether it's security or in concessions and things like that. Those people are often working those as a second job to provide them that last bit of income they need. They're not going to be unemployed necessarily. Some might be, but many won't be. So they may not have safety net provisions to fall back on. We need to do a lot about the safety net, but we also, I think, need to do some things just to help everybody.
So a one-time personal stimulus. And I know a lot of people out there, because they were tweeting me yesterday, were like, why not universal basic income? We will talk about that in just a few minutes here. But Jack, I just want to get your quick sort of first line response to the idea of replicating that 2008, like I said, one-time stimulus that might be able to help tide people over for, say, the next month to 6 weeks.
Well, it's a tested idea. It's a much better idea for the reasons stated over the Social Security cut. And it has this advantage that should recommend itself to Mr. Trump. Studies of that subsidy the government sent out in 2008 showed that the people didn't notice, studies of Social Security tax cuts,
right,
have shown that people don't notice it. They notice the one-time stimulus. So if you're looking for political credit, do the check. Never mind the bleeding out of pennies each week.
No, I mean, that's an excellent point because, except for those of us who obsessively look at our pay stubs at the end of every month or every couple of weeks, there's a big sort of emotional difference between that and getting that check in the mail. So, point well taken, Jack. We want to hear as many stories from our listeners as possible this hour, too. So let me just get a couple of calls in here. Let's go to JD, who's calling from Appleton, Maine. JD, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. I love what you do. My family and I recently went to Mexico. We came back this weekend. We flew through Florida and Logan, and at no point did anyone ask how we felt if we had contact with anyone from any of these countries. When we got back, my wife's employer, who's immunocompromised, put her on a 14-day quarantine. So we're already looking at a month's lost income. She's in the service industry. I have a second job in the service industry. I'm also curious, because we are in Maine, we have a lot of foreign workers come over with J-1 visas. I'm wondering if anyone's even thought about that and how that's going to affect our economy.
Right.
We already remortgaged our home, so we don't really have that as an option. And we're thinking about leading by example and possibly even pulling our kids out of school at this point, because everyone's a week or two behind, it seems like, where they should be.
Well, JD, I'm going to take it back from you there, but thank you so much for sharing your story and for your call. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Columbia, Missouri. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Go ahead.
I farm organically with my folks, and we're having a very difficult time projecting out how much to invest in our seed, our organic fertilizer. Finding the cattle market is already in decline, comparable to the stock market, and it makes planning very difficult. And in farming, you don't have continuous cash flow. So we're at the point of the year where we have a lot of expenses, but no cash flow, which makes life very difficult. Also, self-employed. I currently don't have health insurance. And I'm really looking to the government for some leadership on things like Medicare for All, for instance. And I realize that would never happen under a Trump administration. But I would also like to point out the hypocrisy of NPR, who takes a substantial amount of their funding from large corporations who fight to prevent things like Medicare for All from passing, paid sick leave, living minimum wage. And I would just implore anybody who's listening today to turn off NPR, go to new independent media like The Hill Rising, Secular Talk, The Michael Brooks Show, Jimmy Dore, Status Quo. These are all people who are independent. They are able to speak truth to power because they are not dependent upon these corporations for their funding.
Well, so, Brian, wait, don't go away, Brian. First of all, I want to say I appreciate you sharing your personal story with us.
Thank you.
Don't know about you telling people on NPR right now to turn off what they're listening to, because then they wouldn't have heard your story. So here I am. Here I am. I'm welcoming you here. I want to hear what you have to say. And I'm proud of the journalists that I work with and the organization that I work with for being a place where we can hear your story. I want to say that. So please, I would like you to tell me more. Rather than telling people to turn it off and stop listening to you, I want you to tell me more about, like, what are your finances like right now? I mean, I'm hearing in your story you feel like you can't afford to take a day off. Like, how much do you have in your savings? Because we're trying to get a sense as to how vulnerable Americans feel at the moment.
I have about $600 in my bank account, and my rent is $550. But honestly, I'm not worried about me. Like, I'm a very resilient individual, despite currently have a broken wrist that I'm working through. I'm more worried about everybody else in this country. And I will say that NPR, along with all of corporate media, is currently propping up a Democratic candidate for presidency.
Okay, Brian, this I gave you a chance to, like, help us understand a little bit more. But if you're just going to keep pounding NPR, much appreciated your call. Thank you so much for letting us into your life for a moment. Thank you, Brian. Jay, let me turn back to you, because look, Brian, his concerns about media aside, he was also talking about sort of deeper systemic change here. And I just want to ask, you got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here. But you talked about a one-time stimulus. Beyond that, I mean, what's the sort of most pressing, immediate policy change that could be made so that in the next pandemic, in the future sort of crisis, so many people don't feel as vulnerable?
So the first thing I would say is that instead of just as a one-time, you would tie it to triggers, that if the unemployment rate rises, you're giving money to people on an ongoing basis, but also crucially strengthening the safety net. The safety net in America just has too many holes in it, and we need to do things, whether it's with SNAP or what used to be food stamps, unemployment insurance, things like that, making them stronger programs to make sure people are cushioned once we have a downturn.
Okay, so we're going to talk more about some of those particular programs when we come back. So Jay Shambaugh and Jack Beattie, stand by for a moment. We're exploring the vulnerabilities that are once again being revealed by coronavirus in the for the millions of Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the economic impact that coronavirus may have on millions of Americans who are already living paycheck to paycheck, whether they're going to have to miss some pay periods if they get sick or if the economic activity in the sectors they work at naturally go down as we try to get a handle on this pandemic, what effect that's going to have on them. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. He joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jay Shambaugh is also with us. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of economics and international affairs at Georgetown University. He's with us from Washington. And also joining us now is Andrew Yost. He joins us from Washington as well. He works full-time as a manager at a restaurant, sometimes up to 80 to 90 hours per week. He's got student loans he's got to deal with. He was also formerly in the Marine Corps. So, Andrew Yost, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, first of all, just tell us a little bit about sort of how you're doing now. Do you feel like your finances, your economic life is pretty stable?
Not at all. Yeah, just no.
Why?
So, it's really why is just I have to have all the hours just to pay off my loans. Even though I had the GI Bill coming out, there's a lot of student fraud going around, fraud in general with banks, and I got hit with that, some of that. And so it's like, okay, now I need to work. I need to pay off everything and get myself kind of financially secure. And then this kind of happens, and when you realize that, you're like, well, I can't be sick because I have to have steady income.
So are you living paycheck to paycheck? Is everything that you earn at the end of every couple of weeks or every month going to paying those student loans to housing, et cetera?
Yes. Even this past pay period, or even this past time, or for the month of March, I was supposed to pay my rent. And thank goodness they were meeting with me, but I was 9 days late.
Oh, okay. So how much work do you think you could miss if you had to before things would get to like an emergency level for you?
Realistically, I think I could only be missing 1 or 2 days, but that's not so much just because I would be trying to be financially secure myself. That's because other individuals I work with or that I'm in charge of, just making sure that I'm there for them. Because if someone calls in sick, we're already understaffed. So I have to be the extra person that's picking up stuff. Then, you know, you go, okay, the host needs to clear up the tables. Someone from the kitchen needs to come out and start talking to customers, like crazy stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that kind of stuff.
Now, Andrew, if I could ask, the restaurant that you work at, is it sort of locally owned? Is it a corporate restaurant? What is it?
It is absolutely locally owned.
Okay.
And so if I'm missing days and the business struggles, I could lose my source of income.
Okay. Because I was, you know, margins in the restaurant industry are pretty tight as it is. And I imagine they're even tighter for locally owned businesses. So I was wondering if the owners of where you work have been trying to figure out if there's anything they can do to assist workers if they got to cut back on your hours or even close down for a while.
Yes, no, we've been kind of down on the internet looking at grants, looking for anything we can apply for to actually help ourselves, because this is something that not even the owners can offer, you know, in terms of getting health insurance and such, which is very unfortunate. And then, you know, people that you're in charge of, you kind of give them a schedule, and when you give them a schedule, the first question comes around is, well, you know, so when am I going to see my next paycheck? And, you know, because I'm kind of strapped right now and they're also getting sick and you're in a position where you're like, well, I want to help you, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, just the issues with that.
Right. Well, Andrew Yost, joining us from Washington, works full-time as a manager at a restaurant, has student loans, and also was formerly in the Marine Corps as well. Andrew, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
Jay Shambaugh, let me turn back to you. And first of all, correct an error I made earlier. I said that you were at Georgetown University. My mistake. George Washington University is actually where you are a professor of economics. So my apologies for that.
No problem.
I want to, you know, so Andrew telling us this very familiar story, as we've been hearing throughout this hour, about how he's really on the razor's edge almost every single day. So what are some of the other policies beyond that one-time stimulus that would help? I mean, one that naturally comes to mind is paid sick leave, right?
Absolutely. I think paid sick leave, I think we're seeing in this crisis kind of the real hole that we have in our kind of economic system, that we don't have paid sick leave the way most countries do, and that, you know, half of low-wage workers don't have any paid sick leave at all. And even in some states where they mandated it, it may only be 5 days that you have. And self-quarantining for 2 weeks is obviously going to blow through any of that. And so I think in a situation like this, I think if only the only good thing I think you could say in terms of the way the policy politics are working right now is that both sides are talking about paid sick leave. And I think that's really important. Hopefully they can come together and figure out a sensible way to do it, making sure that people aren't put in this terrible choice of do I go to work sick or do I get paid? And I think hearing Andrew's story is important, though, also thinking about the small business side of this. And it's one reason I think it's really important that right now, whatever we do is actually paid for by the federal government right now in this crisis, because you don't want to turn around and bankrupt the small businesses by mandating sick leave. And frankly, I think what you really want to do is help those small businesses that were already trying to do the right thing by providing sick leave and go ahead and cover it for them, because this is going to be an expensive point in time for them.
Well, to that point, I mean, the president in his speech to the nation last night did talk about that. He talked about working with the Small Business Association, for example, to provide loans during this period. Good idea?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's something you've heard, again, on both sides of the aisle. And I'm hopeful that they can figure out the right way to do it. There are a lot of small businesses that already have loans from the SBA. And so one thing you can do is kind of declare this as an emergency and just say they don't need to pay you back for a while. Just defer the loans. And that's one way just to get them help their cash flow situation. But you can also extend broader loans to small businesses. As I said, I think actually picking up the tab for sick leave for small businesses, the United Kingdom just announced last night that that's what they're going to do for anyone, any firm under 250 employees. They're paying the sick leave right now. Those are the kinds of things you could do. But one thing I think, Meghna, your program's been really helpful in pointing out is that some of the responses you've heard people talk about are industry by industry. Like, let's help the cruise ship industry.
Right.
Let's help the airlines. Let's help the oil industry. But we're talking to people from the restaurant industry, the healthcare industry, broader service industries, farming. This is something that spreads broadly. We can't just try to micro-target industry by industry. We need broad solutions that will support households and individuals and the economy overall.
Well, the thing is can we get bipartisan support for those sort of more comprehensive solutions, even in the midst of of a crisis like we're facing now? Because I just want to play a moment from yesterday in the Senate where Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, called for a vote on an emergency paid sick leave bill. Now, Senator Murray's bill would have required employers to provide 14 days of paid sick leave for public health emergencies such as the current coronavirus outbreak. And here is what Senator Murray said.
Mr. President, workers and their families want to do the right things for themselves and for their communities. But for many of our workers, restaurant workers, truck drivers, service industry workers, they may not have an option to take a day off without losing their pay or losing their job. And that leaves them with the impossible choice between putting food on their table and paying the bills or the rent, or protecting themselves and others.
Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, yesterday in the Senate. Now, that bill subsequently was blocked by Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. Under Senate rules, one senator can try to set up a vote or pass a bill by unanimous consent. Any other senator can also object, which is what Senator Alexander did. And he said, quote, "The idea of paid sick leave is a good idea, but if Washington, D.C. thinks it's a good idea, Washington, D.C. should pay for it." By the way, Alexander happens to be chairman of the Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee as well. And he went on to say, "It's not a cure for the coronavirus to put a big, new, expensive federal mandate on employers who are struggling in the middle of this matter." That's what Senator Alexander said. Jack Beatty, your response to that?
Well, the House bill passed, I think, or it's going to be voted on today. That would address, I think, some of what Senator Alexander was talking about. It would replace two-thirds of wages for workers who are quarantined or who are laid off as a result of the pandemic. And that would be up to $4,000 a month. That wouldn't be a permanent family leave policy, which the senator was objecting to, but it would be and it wouldn't be targeted. It would be across the economy, but it would be a stabilization. It would put money in the hands of the people who wouldn't be affected by the payroll tax cut. So that's a very good. That's a very good alternative, although now I see the House GOP has come out against that. They don't want that or the other elements of the Democratic package. And, you know, Jay mentioned how rare we are in the world. I may be wrong about this, but I think we rank with Papua New Guinea as the only country in the UN caliber of these things that doesn't have sort of family leave. The only country, Papua New Guinea and the USA.
Jay, I mean, are we up there with Papua New Guinea?
We're behind where other advanced economies are, I think, is the simplest way to put it. And we need to do more. We may wind up, and I think the House proposed bill that they proposed last night has a bit of a hybrid where there's the thing that Jack was describing that's kind of an emergency measure and then some other measures that are tied more to employers. I think there are a range of ways you can do this, but I think it's important to do it quickly. There are other things they could do faster, and it may be that they can't come to agreement on this, you know, today, but I hope that doesn't slow them down on things like they really need to help the states' budgets with the health care costs, and they know how to do that. And the House bill, I was really pleased to see, did suggest this last night, which is you increase the share of spending the federal government takes out of Medicaid, because that's a huge line item for the states. It's cost that's probably going to go up in this crisis. And so that can channel, say, $50 billion towards the states to make sure they have the money to do all these things they need to do and to support their communities. So I think there are things around that, around SNAP or what used to be called food stamps or unemployment insurance that we know how to do. We've done them before. We could do them really quickly. And I just hope that those really impactful things, both for families and for states and for the economy, can move through. And honestly, if we can't figure out paid sick leave in the next 12 hours or something, this is why I would suggest sending those checks, is because in some ways it's the first, you know, attempt to stabilize things for households. And maybe you figure out the sick leave in the next week. But I hope they could figure it out today. But if they can't, there are a lot of these things that we could do kind of quickly. And we could also put in triggers that if the unemployment rate goes up half a point, we do even more of those same set of things to make sure if the economy does deteriorate, we're doing enough to support the economy.
Jay, if I may, if we can't figure out paid sick leave in the next 12 hours, Frankly, is there anything about how Congress or Washington is functioning at the moment that gives you even the most minuscule level of hope that that's possible?
I think people's minds are focused today, and I think that's really important. And that's why I said, you know, last week they passed $8 billion in money going to the health agencies, and that was important. And my understanding was there were some discussions last week even about paid sick leave. It wasn't kind of done in time to be in that bill. I think they're going to need to pass some stuff today, especially if they're going on recess soon. And I think you want to do as much as you possibly can. I think the odds that we look back and say we did too much are really, really low. And so we should do whatever we can and then immediately turn to say what's next and what more are we going to do?
Well, so that's the heart of the matter, isn't it? Right. All of the policies and the temporary changes that we've been talking about, from a one-time personal stimulus, as I might call it, to you mentioned SNAP, right? But was it back in 2008 the Bush administration relaxed or waived work requirements for SNAP? Even if there's a temporary paid sick leave bill, that will get some Americans through the next month, but it does very little to solve the fundamental problems about why people are so vulnerable to begin with. There will be another crisis eventually. So until we get to a stronger social safety net, to more secure foundations, economic foundations for Americans of all political persuasions, we're just doing Band-Aids, Jay, aren't we?
We're doing Band-Aids, but we can hopefully do more than just Band-Aids. And this is why I'm saying if you build in some of these things with triggers, then they're happening automatically. And that's something we at the Hamilton Project put out a whole book on this last June of trying to say, here are a whole bunch of things you could just tie to the unemployment rate. And if it starts rising, we know to do them right away to make sure the safety net is strong and there when it's needed. I completely agree with you that every crisis we see in our country and the economy just reveals foundational issues that we have, and we absolutely need to work on those as well to get people a better wage, to get people better jobs. But I also think, honestly, we need to do some things immediately because this is something that's going to really severely impact the number of families.
Point taken. And I like your idea about automatic triggers, right? Because then it takes the politics out of it and it just becomes a policy that we enact when people need it. Jack Beatty, one last question for you. I mean, we're obviously focusing on vulnerable Americans and vulnerable American workers. This is a global economic crisis they were in the grips of as well. But even still with that in mind, without strong safety nets, when any crisis hits, some people are going to be more fragile than others. And that's what we want to try to avoid in the future, isn't it?
It is. The president said something unwanted for him last night. He said, we're all in this together. Well, earlier in the week, he had referred to the governor of Washington as a snake. Leave that aside. We are all in this together. And I think what we're all seeing here is that social provision, money for the poor, money to support people who are vulnerable, is social security for all. If I go into that restaurant and I'm a rich man and my server is trying to work because she can't get by, I'm infected. I'm at risk. We're all in this together.
Well, Jack Beatty is On Point's news analyst. He joins us today from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
And Jay Shambaugh, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University, with us from our nation's capital. Jay, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.